This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll continue our discussion with a Cal Poly leader in advocating for underrepresented students on campus and what the next steps are to promote diversity and inclusion at the university.
We fall short in creating a space and spaces on campus where all students, faculty, and staff have opportunities to succeed.
Also, we'll hear from a San Luis Obispo resident well-versed in the commercial nuclear power industry and the dilemma of safely storing spent nuclear fuel, the subject of current Diablo Canyon power plant discussions.
And the spent fuel is sitting in there, and it's very hot. And if there were some event, an earthquake, which would cause the pool to crack open, all the water would come gushing out.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 11th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Today, we begin our discussion with Title IX. It's a federal law, part of the Education Amendments Act of 1972. Its goal? Prohibit discrimination in educational institutions. One area Title IX presents itself on campuses is to address sexual assault and harassment. But a recent lawsuit in California may be changing how this process is handled on campuses, and it has many students and administrators concerned. Joining us is Monica Vaughn from the San Luis Obispo Tribune. She's been covering this issue. Hi, Monica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so what's the lawsuit and what's at stake here for Title IX?
The lawsuit was brought by an undergraduate student who was expelled from the University of Southern California after they determined that he had forcible and non-consensual sex with a woman. He challenged that determination in court. And an appellate court just ruled with that undergraduate student that the hearing process was unfair and didn't give him the ability to cross-examine the alleged victim and other witnesses. So the judge in this state appellate court found that universities and colleges in California must allow the accused to cross-examine the accuser in a live hearing. That doesn't mean that an alleged rapist will be interviewing the alleged victim necessarily, because the CSU system at least is looking at having a hearing officer that will ask those questions. The big concern about this is that it will reduce the number of people who file complaints with the university about sexual misconduct happening.
Some might argue that cross-examinations is more similar to how it's done in the American judicial system, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of people have said that this is actually bringing balance to a process that has too much favored the alleged victim.
What are students and administrators and lawmakers saying about these changes?
Well, the main concern that I've had from the Title IX coordinators in both the USC system and the UC system is their concern that this hearing process is not the best way to get to the truth. They say that we're committed to identifying the facts that reach the truth of what happened, and this is an educational environment in universities. This is not the justice system. And they're concerned that young developing people will be traumatized again by this process, both the accused and the accuser being in this potentially highly tense, you know, confrontational environment. They've told me that they believe that the process that best gets to the truth is the investigator model.
Did anyone propose ideas they think that might make the process run smoother or better?
One thing that CSU system has told me is that they are committed to not allowing the accused's attorney cross-examine the alleged victim directly. So what that would mean is that instead of the alleged victim facing questions from somebody who has a very clear agenda, there would be a neutral party, like a hearings officer, that would be the person asking that question. In addition, the California court said that video conferencing may be potentially available to the administrators going through this process. Which means that, you know, for example, somebody who's accused another student of sexual misconduct wouldn't have to see them in the same room, you know, share a space with this person that they say assaulted them.
And this impacts cases that were already underway, is that correct?
Yeah, so immediately after the court ruling in early January, CSU sent a memo to all 23 campuses across the state and said, identify the cases that might be impacted by this. The cases that might be impacted by this are cases where the accused is facing serious repercussions, such as expulsion or suspension, and also where the credibility of witnesses is at stake. So the number of cases that have been identified so far that are open that meet those criteria is about 75 cases across the state. The CSU system itself estimates that about 500 cases a year through that system will be affected by this. Of course, that doesn't include all of the private campuses and the UC campuses that also have sexual assault cases that they're going through. And I want to add just a couple things, that the question of whether or not cross-examinations during a hearing format actually gets to the truth of what happened at the incident in question. There's a lot of concerns from psychological experts that say that traumatic memories have gaps. And I spoke with Senator Hannah Beth Jackson out of Santa Barbara, who's very interested in the Title IX process. And she's concerned that it's extremely traumatic. And she offered a scenario in where questioning a student who, you know, maybe was raped at a party or something, what that might look like. And she said, just imagine that this victim, she remembers that she felt hazy at a party before an attack. That's what she remembers. And then she's facing the questions of, how many drinks did you have? Describe the men. Describe what they were wearing. Describe what they did 4 minutes beforehand. You don't remember that. What you do remember is that four men pulled on your pants and raped you. So requiring a victim to respond to those questions at a live hearing is going to discourage women from coming forward. That's what Senator Jackson said, and that's what her concerns are. The problem that we're facing right now is that sexual assault and misconduct and rape are still prevalent at college campuses across the country. And we know the Department of Justice confirms that it's, you know, one of the most underreported crimes in our country and underreported to administrators as well. And there are a lot of concerns that this just means that fewer people will report misconduct.
Now, all this is happening while there are possible separate federal changes coming from the Trump administration to Title IX, correct?
Yes.
And what does that possibly look like?
So people have probably heard the name Betsy DeVos thrown around in regards to these changes. She's the secretary of the U.S. Department of Education. They've proposed an overhaul of the process as well. It's proposed at this point. It has not been adopted. However, they have received more than 100,000 public comments from people that are concerned, either support or are concerned and critical of the changes. The new rules would narrow the definition of sexual harassment, and they would also eliminate the university's responsibility for investigating assaults or harassment that happen off campus. And that's a concern to a lot of people because right now that's where most incidents occur. If you think about, you know, a fraternity or sorority, for example, those are usually off campus, although they're very much tied to the student experience. This would eliminate the university's responsibility to adjudicate those complaints if they don't happen on campus.
So what's next?
So what's next is that the CSU system and the UC system are scrambling to rewrite their policies right now to immediately put into place the results of this court ruling and the new procedures for the hearings. So those policies will come out, you know, any week now. The federal rule changes are still in the pipeline, and we may see something in the fall that completely overhauls the system again.
Monica Vaughn, reporter at the San Luis Obispo Tribune. She's covering changes coming to how Title IX cases may be handled. We're looking forward to hearing more. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Talk soon. You're tuned to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. This is Issues and Ideas. Well, next today, we wanted to bring you a story from our sister station, KCRW. This segment from their podcast, The 805, dives into your trash, or what happens when the end location of your trash, often a landfill, fills up. Here's Jonathan Bastian.
Let's travel to a place that I'm guessing many of you have never seen, probably by choice. That is the dump. We want to spend some time thinking about what we throw away and where it goes. If you live in most parts of Santa Barbara County, that banana peel or chip bag you threw in the trash will probably make its way to the Tahiguas landfill, a 100-acre mound of trash along the Gaviota coast. We've been burying our waste there since 1967, about 200,000 tons of waste each year. And according to the county, that landfill will hit its capacity in about 6 years. Now, in order to extend the landfill's life expectancy by another decade, the county is beginning to build something called the Resource Recovery Project. Construction crews broke ground back in December and plan to open the facility in 2021. KCRW producer Catherine Barnes recently toured the landfill to learn more about where our waste goes and how things are changing. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Jonathan.
Okay, so first off, what does this landfill look like? I got to admit, I've also never been there.
Yeah, well, you've probably driven right by it. Next time you're driving north on Highway 101 and you pass Refugio State Beach, a couple miles after, look to the right, and that's where the Tahiguas landfill is. It's this hilly canyon, like a lot of canyons you pass right there. The difference is that on this piece of land, the terraced, hilly landscape is in fact decades and decades of trash piled up in layers.
And, I mean, it's just crazy to hear because this is like our prized coastline, and I had no idea that they were just stacking trash there. But anyway, there it is.
Yeah, and Sam Dickinson showed me around. He works for the county's Resource Recovery and Waste Management Division, and here's how he describes it.
It used to be a canyon that has been filled in with a lasagna or layer cake honeycomb of trash and dirt again and again for 200 to 300 feet deep.
I love that description. So, Catherine, what gets dumped there?
Well, as you mentioned, 200,000 tons of waste a year gets buried at this landfill. About 37% of that waste is organic material, like coffee grounds, your orange peel, basically food. Another major piece of the pie is construction and demolition material. So that means like treated wood, insulation, all the stuff that makes up a home. A lot of it can't get recycled. And another major hunk is paper and plastic, all the stuff people should put in their recycling bin but don't. Here's Sam again as we're looking down at the trash that's getting dropped off.
You just have to imagine a lot of what's in here could have been reused, recycled, or composted.
Yeah, and I mean, that kind of brings us to recycling. We're always told, reduce, reuse, recycle. I've heard it a million times. So doesn't that make a dent in what we put in our landfill?
It definitely does. But Sam basically says recycling isn't the fix. Reducing our waste and choosing reusable materials is way more environmental than recycling is. And there are several reasons for that. One is that a lot of things we think can get recycled actually can't. Like the plastic bag you might get at a grocery store, it can't be recycled.
That stuff doesn't go anywhere? What do you mean?
Right now, there's no economic market for it. China stopped buying our plastic. So if you throw a chip bag, a plastic grocery bag, any plastics 3 through 7 into your blue bin at home, it might first get sent to a recycling center, but then they send it straight up to Tahiguas. Secondly, recycling still takes a lot of energy. You have to melt the glass, you have to turn paper into pulp. It all has to be repurposed, and all of that takes resources and carbon, so it's not a perfect solution. And lastly, we have to ship a lot of these recyclables long distances. Mixed paper, for example, gets sold and sent to Vietnam, and it takes a lot of fuel to get it there.
Yeah, I have to admit, you're not making recycling sound like a very good option.
Well, it's better than a landfill, but really, reducing and reusing is way better when it comes to your overall carbon footprint. Sam says if you have to buy something in a container, choose things that stay in California. Glass, for example, gets turned into wine bottles and other things. Plastics 1 and 2 are turned into those plastic containers that hold strawberries at a lot of local farms, things like that.
Right. Now, the other thing we often hear about is composting. So does the county offer any composting programs?
Well, the county can't compost your food scraps for you, unless you're a restaurant or a school or some large generator of trash. But they encourage residents to compost at their own home. The county actually sells subsidized compost machines, and they're free if you're a Goleta resident. But the county can't take your banana peel and compost it for you. And that brings me to something I learned that I find kind of hilarious, but mostly really sad. You know all the restaurants that kind of pride themselves in using compostable to-go containers?
I think I do. I mean, these are those brown cardboardy looking things, and I feel like I'm seeing more and more of them.
Yeah, it's often an alternative to styrofoam or plastic. Well, the large majority of them are not getting composted. You would have to literally put them in your own personal compost, and I doubt many people are doing that.
Hold on, explain more about that. What do you mean?
Well, they're made of compostable plant material, but right now, at least, Tejigas doesn't compost anything, like we said. So it's getting buried in the landfill just like all the other food waste. Here's how Sam explains it.
If it were to go in the trash currently, it's just going to sit there and make methane gas.
And that's a huge problem. Landfills produce a lot of methane, and methane is a major contributor to climate change. But I should say, 75% of the methane created at the Tejigas landfill is getting captured and turned into electricity, enough to power 2,500 homes a year, actually. But the downside is the other 25% is getting released into the air. They can't capture all of it. And Sam says that's the equivalent of 20,000 cars on the road each year.
So you've been describing the way things work now. It's really interesting, but it sounds like there's a plan for the future. It's called the Resource Recovery Project. I've heard a little bit about it, but the idea is that things are going to change moving forward, right?
Yeah, so the whole idea of this new facility that the county's building is to reduce the amount of waste that's actually getting buried, therefore reducing methane emissions and extending the life of the landfill. It's basically a master sorting machine, but I'll let Sam explain it a bit more in detail.
There's going to be a materials recovery facility to sort through the trash using screens, fans, people, magnets, optical sorters. We're gonna basically capture any of the missed recyclables or missed organics. Their recyclables will be sold as a commodity, and then the organics are going to be loaded into an anaerobic digester. And in the anaerobic digester, we're going to be capturing the methane gas, and we're going to get a compost product from the material.
So in other words, right now the county isn't composting food scraps from you and me, but soon it will be. And that food waste will still produce methane since it's using anaerobic decomposition, no air. But the county will be able to capture 100% of that methane, not 75% of it, because it's in a controlled facility rather than a dirt pile. And once that compost gets dried out, it'll be sold like a commodity within the county to places like golf courses, parks, and farms.
So this facility, I guess, is going to open in about 2 years. But even then, it seems like Tejigas is still going to run out of land. It's going to hit capacity. So what happens?
Well, once that happens, they are planning to keep running the resource recovery project there. So trash and recycling will still go to Tejigas. Things will get sorted out. The recycling will get sorted. The compost will be made. And then any leftover landfill waste will get exported to another landfill, likely in Santa Maria or Simi Valley. But in the long term, eventually work will stop at Tejigas. And while Sam says you won't see homes getting built on the land or anything like that, they may turn it into a park. Ealing's Park, you might not know this, Ealing's Park in the city of Santa Barbara, that park was once a landfill. And it's actually still releasing small amounts of methane, even though it closed decades ago.
Which is crazy. I mean, it's such a beautiful park, again, in another amazing location. Catherine, this is a lot of information. And what are some of your main takeaways from learning all of this? What are some little things that we can keep in our mind day to day?
Well, the advice I'd give is to just start looking at your waste. So when you throw something in your trash or recycling, think about where it'll end up. Check what type of plastic your yogurt cup is made of. And if something doesn't feel good to you, think about alternatives. Buy food that doesn't come in plastic. Eat everything on your plate. Start a compost pile. Get a reusable coffee mug. I bring my own glass to-go container to restaurants when I know I'm getting takeout. Just like knowing where your food comes from is important, knowing where your waste goes is important too.
Catherine Barnes, producer, KCRW. Thanks so much for taking us on a tour of the dump.
Anytime.
That was Jonathan Bastian with a story from the KCRW podcast, The 805. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Before retiring, San Luis Obispo resident Alex Carlin was a judge on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The NRC is the federal regulatory body for commercial nuclear power plants. Carlin now sits on the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel. In the first part of our conversation, which we aired in February and is available on the KCBX website, Carlin talked about how he and others are calling for an independent panel to oversee the Diablo Canyon decommissioning process. Not the one he sits on, which was created and staffed by PG&E. He also spoke about a number of issues surrounding the planned closure of Diablo Canyon, from what will happen in the pristine acreage around the facility owned by the now bankrupt PG&E, to how the bankruptcy could possibly accelerate the planned closure date. Today, we continue this conversation between Alex Carlin and KCBX's Greta Mart.
On spent nuclear fuel, I guess one point I would like to make is The radiological risk out at Diablo Canyon is low. It's clearly very low.
Why?
Well, because it's regulated very heavily by the NRC. And right now, people living in and around the community are not being exposed to seriously problematic levels of any radiation. However, if PG&E wanted to reduce that already low risk significantly, the one biggest thing they could do is take the spent nuclear fuel out of the pools and put it into dry casks. But PG&E is not doing that. In fact, in its decommissioning plans that it submitted in December, PG&E seemed to say, or did say, that they're going to hold the current program in abeyance and wait until basically 2032. To remove the spent fuel from the pools. And the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee, the California Energy Commission, the Board of Supervisors of San Luis Obispo, over the past few years, they've all urged PG&E to accelerate the removal of spent nuclear fuel from the pool to the dry casks. And unfortunately, they've come up with a lot of reasons why they just can't seem to do it.
And very simplistically explain, what does that mean?
No, that's a fair question. I mean, when a nuclear power reactor has fuel in it, the fuel is in rods that kind of look like pencil rods, except they're like 12 feet long. And these fuel rods contain highly radioactive material. And once the fuel is finished its useful life, it's called spent fuel, and it has to be removed from the reactor. So every year or two, PG&E shuts down a reactor temporarily and removes the spent fuel rods from the reactor. And they're very hot. Their temperature is hot. I mean, 900 degrees Celsius or more. These are very hot pieces of rods of metal. And they're put into a pool right in near the same building. There's a pool of water. It's a deep pool of water that these spent fuel rods are put into the pool. They need to cool down. And they cool down over a course of years. And once they're cool, temperature is cool, they're still highly radioactive, they can then be put into dry storage casks. So another operation occurs where the crane takes the spent fuel from the pool and puts it into a casks, a big, huge, you know, 16, 18 foot tall, thick cask.
And like a metal box?
It's a metal can with concrete around it. And so there's a process where the spent fuel is removed from the reactor, put into a pool temporarily, and then it's removed from the pool after it's cooled off a bit and put into these dry casks and sit up on a pad dry. And it's much safer in the dry cask than it is in the pool.
Because if there were, like, let's say, I'm totally hypothetical, if there was an earthquake, maybe the pool would break and the water would come out and that'd be all radioactive?
Exactly. That's one of the issues that they're concerned about, is that you've got this pool of water and the spent fuel is sitting in there and it's very hot. And if there were some event, an earthquake, which would cause the pool to crack open, all the water would come gushing out. Now, there are mechanisms to refill those pools on an emergency basis. They have water available for that, but if, God forbid, the pool would become dry and the hot fuel was in there, there are scenarios where that fuel would melt down into a glob, and then it would bubble and boil, and it wouldn't have an atomic reaction. It wouldn't blow up or anything, an atomic bomb, but it could emit nuclear radiation out from the reactor building. And that's what you want to avoid. And so the NRC has a risk-based levels of how you can reduce the radiological risk. And one of the prime level reductions is, first, get it out of the pool. You get it from the pool and put it into the dry cask. That's a big drop in your radiological risk, according to the NRC. And so it's hoped that PG&E can find ways to accelerate the offloading of the spent nuclear fuel from the pools into these dry casks. That's step number one. The second step is get the dry casks out of San Luis Obispo County and send them to a proper disposal facility or a properly licensed storage facility. Those are the two biggest things we could do to reduce radiological risks at Diablo Canyon.
Okay, well, thank you for explaining. I understand it a heck of a lot better. And yes, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
So after hearing this, what if people in San Luis Obispo County say, you know what, we like that idea of PG&E moving faster about putting it in the cask. Is there something that the general public can do to make them do this?
Well, not particularly,
okay.
I have to say. I mean, we can advocate and express our concerns to PG&E. I think they'll listen to some extent and try to do so. I'm not sure why they haven't pursued this more aggressively in the past. They come up with all sorts of reasons why it's difficult. They'll need to get a license amendment. Well, that's fine. They get those all the time. They need to do some technical things. Yes, they can. But if they put their heart and mind to it, I think they could get the casks, the spent fuel, out of the pool a lot faster. What can we do? The NRC is the regulator of radiological issues, and the NRC—
They're the ones that would tell them you have to do this.
The NRC could force them to do this, but the NRC isn't going to do that. They are pretty much neutral on this issue, and as far as they're concerned, you can leave it in there until 2025 and then, or 2032. The NRC figures it's safe either way. They figure it's safe either way, but they do acknowledge that it would be safer if it was out of the pools.
Wow. Okay. What about the California Public Utilities Commission? Do they have any authority to direct this?
Well, CPUC controls the money. The ratepayers are paying for all of this, and the PUC sets the rates that will pay for these activities. PG&E, among other things, says it's cheaper to leave it. The way I read it, they're saying it's cheaper to leave it all in the pool until it's all cooled off. 7 years after the reactor closes. It takes about 7 years. It could do it faster, but let's just say 7 years is what they're saying. So 2025, the reactors close. 2032, which is 7 years later, PG&E plans to offload all the fuel at once. And you see, in a way, that's cheaper because you have to set up a big logistical operation to get this fuel and pull it out with the cranes, put it into transporters, and move it into the casks. And if you can do it all at once, it's cheaper than doing, you know, three or four, you know, cans 1 year and two or three next year. And, you know, so ultimately, there may be money that can be saved. So the PUC is the one who does the rate setting and costs allocation, and they may say, well, it's probably worth it to get that fuel out of there faster. So if it costs a little more money, that's fine. Do it. But I don't know that there's any there's no formal mechanism that we have to, as citizens, to force this to happen. I think we can just advocate and hope that PG&E will listen.
That was Alex Carlin, a retired Nuclear Regulatory Commission judge who now sits on the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel. To hear the complete interview, head to kcbx.org. And this week, the engagement panel is hosting a hearing for the public about spent nuclear fuel storage at Diablo. The hearing will take place in the downtown Slo County Government Building on Wednesday, March 13th at 6 p.m. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, part two of our conversation with a champion for increasing awareness of diversity and inclusion at Cal Poly, and the lessons she brings into her own classroom.
None of us move forward in this world without support. I can't think of anybody that has had any success where they haven't had someone, a group of people, or a set of circumstances that have helped guide them along the way.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Tyler Pratt. Last week, we spoke at length with the inaugural winner of Cal Poly's Martin Luther King Legacy Award for her efforts in advocating for underrepresented students. Her name is Camille O'Brient. We discussed the programs that she's launched on campus to strengthen the campus community and the struggles many students face on campus. We kick off part two of our conversation today about her efforts to promote awareness of diversity and inclusion in her own classroom.
I teach a course called Sports and Gender. And it is looking at how gender, race, ethnicity influence the way we organize sports and can sometimes serve as barriers to opportunity to participate or not. When I first started teaching that class, it was almost all white men who would sign up for it because probably about sport in the title. I don't know. It was kind of interesting, right? And so there I am, and the first day we're talking about feminism and feminist theory and all the different ways in which feminism can, you know, be interpreted or viewed. And so, like, maybe it's day two or three, we go through an exercise in the class on intersectionality. And so the intersection of all the different identities that people have. And so even if it's a class almost all men, almost all white men, they begin to see that they have other parts of their identity, their religion, their sexual orientation, their, you know, where they grew up, if they speak another language at home, right? All these different types of parts of identity that may not be as visible. And we have a conversation about, you know, the privilege and opportunity and how, you know, sometimes parts of my identity give me privilege, access to things that you might not have the same privilege as I do, right? And so they're in small groups and they sort of get to play around with the idea of, like, what parts of their identity do they think that allow them privilege in their social worlds and what parts of their identity don't. And we don't have, like, necessary answers about that, but just that awareness that there's more to them than being a white man, or there's more to me than being a black woman. And I think it helps them when I use myself as an example. I'm not afraid to talk about some of the negative experiences I've had when someone has called me the N-word. Now that I have my PhD, though, you know, I'm like, I know, PhD privilege. And so that's Dr. N. You know, I say, that's Dr. N, you know, if you're going to call me that, you know, get it right. Don't get it twisted. It's a way to sort of start a conversation, break down some misinterpretations. Of course, always grounding it in, you know, additional readings and resources. And it's not just anecdotal. I can show them, you know, data, research around the topics we bring up. And it gets us started, right? And it helps them become, it helps people understand how they can be allies, right? Because none of us move forward in this world without support. I can't think of anybody that has had any success where they haven't had someone or a group of people or a set of circumstances that have helped guide them along the way. I know that for myself for a fact. Having them to understand their identities and how they are either feelings, having points of privilege or not, I think helps and helps me also for my own points of privilege be better at being an ally to people.
A very visible push on campus over the past year since I've been here to really increase awareness of diversity and inclusion mm-hmm. at Cal Poly.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Definitely, definitely. When I think about the Cal Poly of, you know, when I left in 2003 and what I came back to in 2004, I mean, we have grown in leaps and bounds as an institution, not just in wanting to be aware of and engage with diversity and inclusion because we should, you know, because that's what everybody else is doing. It's because it's a value that's at the core of the institution. At every level, wherever I turn, there is acknowledgement of the importance of recognizing that we fall short and creating a space and spaces on campus where all students, faculty, and staff have opportunities to succeed. And sometimes we fall short because of our own ignorance or, you know, there's things just are inherent in our policies. We're an institution that is built out of exclusion, right? We don't accept everybody that applies. So already we're sort of, by virtue of being the highly competitive, success-driven institution that we are, we set ourselves up for the challenge of helping people feel included, if that makes sense. It's just been neat to see, you know, from the admissions all the way through to the Alumni Association saying, you know, we need to acknowledge that we have problems with retaining and recruiting people of color onto our campus. And we have problems with graduating or seeing students be successful at similar rates. So there's a gap in how there's a gender gap, actually. Men don't graduate at rates as high as women over 4 or 6 years, right? Students of color don't graduate at rates as high as white students, depending on how you want to parse the data out. So why is that, right? I don't think it's because they lack the ability. They wouldn't have gotten into Cal Poly if they lacked the ability. It's something about the climate, the institution, how we kind of go about our daily lives that reinforces any types of already existing individual or institutionalized forms of racism and sexism and, you know, classism, all those things. So I think we're doing better at least acknowledging that we have some problems and we're trying, I think, as an institution to collect data and educate ourselves around what it is that's getting in the way of people being successful. Oh, it's not just one thing. It's probably multiple things, right? We already talked about money, finances, but it's you know, just walking around campus and having people stare at you or ask you questions. I still get asked sometimes how the basketball team's doing. How's it going, coach? People just assume maybe I'm a coach. I used to coach, never basketball. But, you know, they don't know that I'm a professor. They'll see me and just maybe how I'm walking. I got my backpack on. You know, I'm fairly tall for a woman and just make the assumption that I'm an athlete or a coach. So that fits the stereotype.
We've talked a lot about the student population there. Mm-hmm. If you don't mind taking a minute to talk about faculty at mm-hmm. Cal Poly, mm-hmm. do you feel faculty of color or queer faculty are adequately represented on the campus?
Nope, I don't. You know, do I feel that there's adequate or a reasonable representation of faculty, queer faculty and staff of color? No, I think it's, I don't know all the specific numbers off the top of my head. You know, I have seen an increase in the number of faculty of color in my college. That has come from very intentional advocating for diversifying our applicant pools, building our networks, you know, in terms of how we advertise. We don't just go to the Chronicle of Higher Education. You know, we make sure we're putting ads in a variety of publications. We make sure that, you know, people are carrying the information to professional associations. We're asking questions of our applicants where they can talk about their commitment to creating inclusive learning environments. So, you know, we're being very, very intentional in who we're able to get into the applicant pools. And then the interview process, once folks come on campus, I think has really improved. And part of that is a credit to the Office for Diversity and Inclusion and Human Resources. You know, they've created guides and provide training on implicit bias and the kind of things that can make it difficult to hire or look for people to hire who are different than you. We still think our biggest shortfall is in African American faculty and staff. A few years ago, over a period of 18 months, we lost something like, you know, 8 out of 32 African American faculty and staff in an 18-month period.
And your college?
No, just Cal Poly in general. I don't think there's any one reason why folks left. I mean, I think that probably a lot of some reasons why I left. It was hard to find my fit, sense of belonging, right? This chronic exposure to microaggressions is like death by a thousand cuts. I think you might have heard that phrase before. You've seen maybe the video on YouTube with, you know, having the mosquito just sting you over and over and over again. And, you know, at some point you just explode, right? I'm like, I've had enough. It's not that it's too hard. It's just too exhausting. So I think that campus climate issues, lack of acceptance and explicit, statements of you're not welcome here. It comes in a variety of forms for people. Even though there was good efforts like with Beacon Mentor growing and the establishment of the Office for University Diversity and Inclusion, you know, a president, a provost, we have vice presidents, people that really, really want to engage and value diversity and inclusion. Where the learning curve is so steep, the institution wasn't quite ready to meet the needs of the people that were here at that time. So, you know, now fast forward a few years, I think we're better now. People in leadership positions on campus are more aware of, are able to articulate, are able to model the type of inclusive environment that they aspire to, that we aspire to, that I aspire to. And it's not perfect, you know. We still have a lot of room for growth. But I think it's nice when I sit in the role of an associate dean, and regardless of the student who crosses the threshold, that I can engage with them and meet them where they're at. I don't make any assumptions about who they are because of the color of their skin, but I am aware that there might be things that they're experiencing differently because of the color of their skin or their gender or their gender expression or gender identity or their sexual orientation. But I'll talk with them about that. And I think that sometimes the student's like, wow, you actually care about me, or you want to know a bit more about who I am and not just what my grades are. And that sets the stage for the conversation about what are your grades like and why they're like what they are.
I have to ask you, while you're here, this shift change in thinking about diversity and inclusion, do you think it goes all the way up the ladder of the administration at Cal Poly?
I think it does. I think it does go all the way up the ladder that, you know, the president and all the vice presidents and my interactions with them, you know, people are not afraid to ask tough questions. I don't think I'd want to be president of a university or a college right now. I can see it's hard to say and do things to please all people. But I think, and I'm not speaking specifically about any one person, I'm just thinking about presidents in higher education or chancellors in general, I think that they have to really surround themselves with a team of folks that can help them see their vision and their values through. I can see where it gets more and more challenging when you get beyond the walls of the institution and you're dealing with alumni. Because I'm not an alum of Cal Poly, but I'm an alum of two different universities. And so, as an alum, I know how hypercritical we can be of the folks on our college campuses and always wanting to say, well, you could do a better job, or why aren't you doing this? You know, why aren't you responding more quickly? You know, Cal Poly is a part of a large, 23 campus public university system, and it's maybe not as nimble and able to respond as quickly as people want them to. But I think our president and our vice presidents are getting better at responding and acknowledging the hurts that are out there, without fear of them somehow, some way devaluing what alums or other constituents external to the institution might feel is important. What counts is the people that are here now. And if we're not, my Uncle John would say, if you're not here to serve the students, you're in the wrong place. And that's been a part of my philosophy ever since I started teaching in higher ed.
What would you say to incoming or prospective students and their parents thinking about Cal Poly or preparing to come next year?
Strap on your skates. This is going to be an adventure. Coming to Cal Poly, you really need to realize you're part of a community of people with a lot of different experiences and values and hopes and dreams. And, you know, we want everybody to be successful. But when you find yourself having trouble, these are the resources that exist on campus to help you, right? We're here to work with you. We're not here to give. I can't take your chemistry class for you. You don't want me to take your chemistry class for you. But I can help give you advice about when you start having trouble in the class, or whether it's with studying for exams or something that someone says to you. You know, here are the people you can talk to maybe figure out how to feel better about that or get past the hurts that might be impacting your experience.
What's next for you?
So what's next for me is to continue to engage with, my colleagues in the college, colleagues around campus, faculty, staff, students. I'm co-advisor of a newly formed student club called Mustangs United, and this club was born out of the Love, Empathy, Respect campaign. When we talk with students about it during orientation, a couple of students are like, we love this. We want to do the same for students. How do we get going? So we have a newly chartered student club called Mustangs United. So I look forward to, you know, working with them and the other advisors and activities or programs to see how we can make everybody find their home, their fit at Cal Poly. And my days are pretty full. I do a lot of advising, meetings.
Sounds like it. Just looking at your schedule and the things that you're doing, you stay very full.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And if I, you know, one thing in the wake of winning this award is it made me really reflect on how much I've benefited from not just Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, because we're still, the civil rights movement is still ongoing. But all the people that, had the similar hopes and dreams, right? My family members, my advisors, my own advisors, my mentors. And as people have interacted with me over social media these last few weeks, I have just become even more hopeful about all our efforts will pay off.
What are you hearing on social media?
That people are thankful that I've been a part of their life, that I, like, I've heard from former athletes, former students, cousins, you know, across the generations, and they said, you know, when they knew me back then, they could see that I cared, and it's nice to see the recognition now. And it's not just me being recognized, but me being able to fulfill the dream of so many other people. What I could do to facilitate someone else's success, that's the greatest gift that I think I can ever receive. You know, my hope and dream is to continue to be able to empower others to meet their hopes and dreams.
That was Camille O'Brien, an associate dean in the College of Science and Mathematics at Cal Poly, who's been with the university for over two decades and was the recent inaugural recipient of Cal Poly's Martin Luther King Legacy Award for her efforts in advocating for underrepresented students. You can hear the full interview on kcbx.org. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. One more story before we let you go today. Journeys of Discovery's Tom Wilmer is back to take us to a Central Valley olive ranch to get to know the process of making olive oil and the Cal Poly grad behind it.
Here we are in Lodi, California with Mike Coldani, chief olive oil maker and head of farming operations at his family ranch in Lodi. Mike, you went to Cal Poly.
Yes, I was a crop science major there. Graduated about 2003.
Did you learn things that were hands-on applicable to your family ranching here?
It was. I grew up farming, and so...
So you knew the drill.
A lot of that, yeah. But, you know, they've got their learn-by-doing mantra. And
one of the things that always interests me about the ag program at Cal Poly, since it is so hands-on, learn-by-doing, you're already doing that before you got there.
Yeah.
So how is it ramped up? You know, is it tutoring from your prof that giving you hands-on insights, or, you know, why is it worth for you to go there?
Probably, you know, what you got a taste of was a lot of the newer technology. I mean, when I was going to school, things like GPS and stuff were just coming out, and so you were able to see these, you know, high-dollar machinery and equipment and learn about it.
You would not have gotten if you stayed here on the farm.
Yeah, or even had a chance to kind of play with. But I think probably the most beneficial thing I've seen coming out of the College of Ag at Cal Poly was just a lot of the connections. I had friends there that got me into the olive oil business or even olive growing business, but even other ag businesses, you know, for our flavored oils, we call on produce brokers or people growing different produce, whether it's citrus down in Southern California or garlic over on the coast.
A lot of the connections you made, literally, either fellow students or presenters or whatnot at Cal Poly.
And if it's not, I'm not working with them directly. I know someone that is in that industry. I can call them, go, hey, who's someone to call on this? And it's really warm introductions. And I think that's been the greatest benefit
away,
I've seen.
Beyond that, what's the second level that made it worthwhile for you to spend 4 years there?
One, I met my wife there, and
that
was been a plus. And then, you know, really just having that school, I think I see that, you know, they started a viticulture program since I've been there. They're kind of been on the forefront of looking at a lot of these ag sectors and, you know, creating a program for it there. And I think that's important. I think California especially produces so much for our nation, and that farming is important. So I think it's great that they're, you know, you've got schools, ag schools like that, that can, you know, help keep people in ag.
What sort of field projects did you do at Cal Poly, literally out in the field?
In some of my classes, we'd go through pruning or harvesting a number of different things. They had avocado and citrus groves on site. And being up here in Northern California, I wasn't familiar with that. So I got to see, you know, how they would prune or harvest those. We're pretty familiar with vineyard up here, but they were just kind of getting in that when I graduated. And so I think that was great. All the way down to real life applications. We had visited other ag schools in the state that had top of the line equipment and stuff, but that's not always practical. I remember specifically a class where we were supposed to go out and calibrate a tractor for a spray rig. We're trying to get it started to do our job and it wasn't working. And we were having to basically a handful of us that were already in ag had to sit around on our backs under this tractor and get it working. But that's real life farming. You're not always have a brand new equipment. And so just kind of our class at the time, putting our minds together and tackling a problem. I remember it specifically because that was seemed real to me.
So when you came back after you graduated, you came back to the family farm. And you made some changes. You made some new applications of visions that you saw. Tell us about
sure.
that.
So we were mostly row crop farmers, and we kind of wanted to diversify a little bit and get into planting some permanent crops. And so we decided to, you know, jump in with both feet and plant olive trees. And originally thought we would just sell the olives as a commodity, but it kind of snowballed into keeping the oil and creating a label and a brand. And
what was the temptation?
Really, it was in this business, it's actually really nice to see the reaction you get. You're selling a healthy food product and really it's easy to sell. If someone tastes it, they generally like it. After you get it in their mouth, the sale is easy. And so
you made more work for yourself in the process.
I think, you know, a little bit was just trying to diversify. The olives was something new for us. And so in farming, different commodities are up and down and you never really know. You're always hoping for the best, but there's so many factors. And so, you know, we end up putting some walnuts in as well. Having some fruit and tree crops just helped our family diversify.
One of the problems with olive oil is, or challenges I should say,
sure,
is you can't go, I'll just age this for 4 years, right?
Right.
And wait for the market to turn around.
Right.
You have the opposite problem, that fresh is best.
Right. So, you know, as soon as we make it, that's as good as it's going to get, and it kind of goes downhill.
You're under the gun.
We are. Our goal is really to sell out of everything we've produced within the year before the next harvest. And so as soon as harvest is over, we're hitting the road and trying to push it and try to educate people that buying the new oil is healthier and it's the best bang for your buck, so to speak. I mean,
how many people do you meet that don't understand that?
You know, when we first got into this around 2007, I think is when we started the company, even myself, you know, we've gained so much knowledge over the years, but the consumers were a lot less educated. And I think due to different news and media releases over the last 10 years, we found that the consumer's gotten a lot more educated. And so I think it takes a long time, but I always compare it to the wine industry, where it wasn't that long ago that the U.S. consumer was buying red, white, and blush, and a lot of it was out of a jug, you know. And so now everyone's really sophisticated. They know what varieties, what regions, what brands, and that's, you know, I don't know if olive oil will ever get to that point, but if it could, you know, it's the same where different varieties of olives have different tastes, and maybe you'll have someone that carries two different varieties in their shelf.
Let's talk about first press virgin olive oil in California, which is a whole different story than if you and I went to Trader Joe's and we saw an Italian or whatever that was first pressed virgin olive oil.
Sure.
We don't know what we're getting if it's Italian, but you do know if it's from California. Explain why.
Well, there's a lot of great oils, I'm sure, made over in Europe. And whether they make their way here or not, or how long it takes to come here, you know, because we live in California, you got so many commodities grown here, I think it's important that people know where their food comes from.
You have regulations and certifications to prove its purity.
So we belong to the California Olive Oil Council. We send our oil every year to them, and it's not only a chemical test, but a taste test, because an oil can meet extra virgin quality standards on paper with a chemical test, but it could have a taste defect in it as well. And so you wouldn't know that unless they have a taste test that goes along with it. Those are just kind of things that we do to try to, you know, uphold a quality standard. A lot of it's got to do with reputation as well. If we put a sub-quality oil in our label and it goes wrong,
it'll backfire.
You're kind of done. And so, you know, we've just created standards that we hope to be completed next year. So that'll be the next chapter of this and kind of grow both those brands. I hope to envision our kids. I've got a 3-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 9-year-old. They're usually running around during harvest, and they've been immersed into the olive oil, you know, just by nature, and hope someday they'd like to work with us as well.
You do other things other than olive trees.
Yeah. So we farm about 1,000 acres, so there's a lot of different row crops in there as well, and we have about 150 head of beef cattle. We've got a real estate company. Wear many hats in here.
When do you sleep?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Especially during harvest, there's not much sleep.
Mike Holdani, what a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, nice meeting you as well.
Do you have a website somebody could check you guys out?
It's at calivirgin.com, and calivirgin's just, it's like Cali and Virgin, C-A-L-I-V-I-R-G-I-N.
Thanks again, Mike.
Thank
what
you.
A pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Lodi, California. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.